Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1455.PS11516, certificate number 48059, the Zaire Space Program.
Come on, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, engine start.
Futurelings no doubt know. I mean, for one thing, congratulations, you've gotten almost to the end of the Omnibus. You, if you're listening alphabetically.
That's right.
Made it all the way to the Zaire space program.
All of the Zizix topics are much later.
This is not our last show that we've recorded yet, I believe. Isn't there another Z show? I'm looking right now and I can't find it.
Zambonis?
The Zyder Z.
Oh, the Zyder Z, right.
I knew there was one. But, you know, you've got, you know, it's not over yet, but, you know.
I'm going to do Zambonis now that I said it.
Zambonis and zebrafish are coming up, but definitely we're at kind of the downward falling action if there is a narrative arc of this thing.
You know, now it feels like a challenge. Now I'm going to try and do as many Z episodes as I possibly can.
I just want the first entry. Like when you listen to this thing, I don't want you to hear John first.
Have we done aardvarks?
No.
Well, do I have the first entry alphabetically?
I don't even know. Let me see. Hold on. There's no good way to do this.
I'm going to do aardvarks too.
Albanian bunkers, apparently.
Hey, there I am again.
You're everywhere from A to Z. The other thing about our day that a future listener will know, besides that we took a while to get to Zaire space program, is that we are... not an interplanetary species at this point. We know you are.
Right.
Congratulations. Good job with the Mars-domed cities and the floating Venusian Bespins. Good job with your Bespins.
But as far as contemporaneously with our lifespan.
Here in the year of our Lord, 2021.
We are not yet interplanetary. We want desperately to be. Adam Savage has said many times, He would take a one-man mission to Mars if he offered it to him.
Yeah, I feel like Jamie would put him on a one-way rocket to Mars as well.
But my friend David Reese has said also that he would take a one-way trip, and I think Jonathan Colton also said. And it feels like
this is not a representative sample. It just turns out you have really misanthropic futurist friends.
Well, you know, a couple of those guys have families and kids, but it does feel like...
What do you think Christine would think about him saying, yeah, I'd leave you all in a heartbeat for the red planet?
I wonder if she wouldn't also be in favor of it.
There are a lot of perks to
it. Con Dios.
I got to say, my marriage has been going great in an LA hotel room.
Yeah, right. But you're the only one in the LA hotel room.
That's the secret. That's going to be the secret of my marriage book.
Right on. Maybe I should have thought about marriage more carefully if I knew you could One of the partners could be in an LA hotel room.
Just marry some Ukrainian catalog person and then just leave her in Ukraine.
Sound of typing.
Like, you don't have to bring her over. I mean, she would prefer it probably, presumably. Mm. Maybe she's just in it for the love of the love of the game.
I think probably if I married her and then sent checks back to the Ukraine, that would be fine with almost any Ukrainian bride.
We are in a bit of a trough space-wise, in fact. Like, you'd think, you know, for a century, we just assumed we would be ramping upward toward conquest of space.
Ugh, I'm so bummed, and I know you are bummed too.
Every day when I wake up,
I feel
good
program?
For a second, and then I remember we haven't been to the moon in 52 years, and my heart just sinks.
We got so off track there in the 1970s, and I understand why. There was a pretty powerful social pushback.
We had inflation to whip.
Yeah, we sure did, and we had to do it now.
That was the best time to whip inflation.
But also, yeah, right, all those things, like, it just seemed like we spent so much money in the 60s, and there was so much, you know, gung-ho derring-do. We got to the moon, and now what? And after that, it just sort of, I don't know, the space shuttle could have been, you remember the space shuttle, the Pan Am space shuttle in the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey?
The space shuttle should have been cool.
It should have looked like the Concorde.
And they tried to market it as a toy, and it just looked like a bus, because it was.
It looked like a bus.
And maybe it was the wrong idea.
A dump truck.
Like, is that really that exciting that you can reuse a fuel tanks and boosters? Yay!
No, it was a terrible idea. They should have built a moon base. That should have been the next thing. Moon base and then mining camp.
Right, because that's what gets kids into science fiction.
Well, listen, you know what prospecting. Gets, you know what gets kids into science fiction? It's trade wars.
Yes, exactly. Kids today prefer the prequels because they love trade routes.
They do,
and the complications thereof.
Trade federations. That's right.
And you like it when the people on those trade routes have maybe, you know, pretty racist accents.
It's if they can be weirdly Asian seeming. Yeah.
And then you want a Middle Eastern underclass and a Jamaican comedic class?
Yeah, Jamaicans that live under the ocean.
It's all very important.
Boy, terrible, terrible, terrible movies.
In our day, the light at the end of the tunnel is that our billionaires will save us.
Oh, I think this is what makes me wake up every morning with a giant smile on my face. Thank God for the billionaires.
They're once again doing their part.
That's why we can't tax the rich.
Carnegie built us libraries.
Thank you.
And
thank you for your service.
And Elon is going to build us
space elevators.
Podcast studios on Mars.
Yes.
And
what happened to space elevators?
Yeah.
What about those ribbons that were going to hang down from space and we were going to just be able to send shipping containers one after the other?
It'd be so easy.
Yeah, it seems like it was all, you know what it is? It's all Kevlar. We need to improve the tensile strength of Kevlar.
That's the one thing holding us back.
See, this is what I wake up every morning thinking about. Why don't we have more tensile strength?
I just thought it was, you're going to have planes having to veer around all the space elevators. What a hassle.
Oh, interesting. Of course.
Every time they show people flying in future cities in, you know, Blade Runner or Back to the Future 2, it seems extremely dangerous, right? Like all the flying cars in Back to the Future, I'm just like, there is an accident every 90 seconds on this thing. You can tell.
Well, you know, I believe that the cars will have, you know, there's enough processing power that they'll be able to stay out of each other's way. What's interesting about all the realistic science fiction movies is the cars are never more than about 600 feet above the ground, which seems like kind of, I mean, kind of technologically reasonable, but also not very safe, but you don't need a floating car to get you from one end of town to the other. You need floating cars to get you between here and San Francisco. I guess those are called airplanes.
You're saying these people in these movies, like Deckard, should just take the bus.
Well, yeah, but I guess the fascination with people making science fiction movies in the 80s was with traffic gridlock. That's what they were trying to solve. And I guess that's what we're trying to solve now with floating cars, right? Gridlock. If you're rich, you should be able to get downtown to your office building faster than the pores.
Right. It's seeing the helicopters that actual millionaires have today and extrapolating.
But nobody's going to work downtown in 25 years.
That's what they didn't think. What if like those people had just called an Uber? Like Deckard doesn't have a flying car, but he has like a little screen in his pocket that calls an Uber.
Nobody would have believed it. It's too outlandish.
Exactly.
Flying cars are more reasonable.
Have you been reading, I mean, speaking of the 70s, people are filling.
No, I haven't been reading. It's 2020s. What are you talking about?
People have been filling plastic bags with gasoline. So this is not a good sign for the space program.
Just now? Recently?
Yeah, today.
Why are people filling plastic bags with gasoline?
The pipeline that got hacked. We're recording this in late May.
Oh, see, I'm not on the internet, so I don't know what's happening. The pipeline got hacked. I did see that. And so
people are panic buying gas. And the U.S. consumer agencies are actually having to like tweet and announce, please do not fill plastic bags with gasoline.
What's fascinating about gasoline.
So it's like more, it's like a more apocalyptic or dystopian vision of 1970s.
Can you imagine people hoarding gasoline? I love it. Oh, they're all going to set themselves on fire. Oil is one of those commodities where the actual oil that we're using today was traded many, many months ago. The price of the oil that we're using at the pump today was established months and months and months
ago. It's like looking at Alpha Centauri.
But the people selling oil, gas companies, right. Oil companies, are more than happy to.
It's weird that now it's $4.50.
just throw that price right into the mixmaster.
Anyway, so that does not look good for our rosy future in space, except again for the billionaires.
You're right, the billionaires.
But I've noticed, I've seen like a couple interviews recently where Elon Musk has been, Jeff Bezos, the late Paul Allen, all billionaires who have their eyes on the solar system.
For the futurelings, these are the heroes of the human race.
Kids love them.
Yeah.
Collect trading cards. When they go on Joe Rogan, they put it on the big screen in Times Square.
Yes.
Everyone loves these guys. And they have all seen the writing on the wall. And instead of turning their, eight figure net worths on
eradicating the Zika virus
or fixing global warming or whatever, they have essentially told everyone, hey, we've given up on Earth.
Right.
This is for you guys to grind into the ground. I'm going to be elsewhere.
Now let me ask you, Ken Jennings,
and all my rich friends.
Ken, as a fellow rich utopian,
I'm not. Why am I a rich utopian?
Well, you're rich and you're a utopian.
I want to say 11 digits, probably. I'm rethinking my 11 digits. Multi-billionaire.
What are they hoping to get out of space? They aren't mining any of these planets yet, and without mining them, what the heck benefit is it? This is the argument against going to space from the early 1970s.
They would all say it's adventure.
This is the Richie Havens argument against going to space.
They would all say it's adventure.
Adventure.
I think.
But the thing is, even when
vision. It's vision.
I see.
Like this is the next frontier, or frontier, as Captain Kirk would say.
But the Europeans that set out across the ocean in the 15th century, they were looking to go mine things. It seems like that's the real human desire is to get gold and platinum out
of things. So I think the unspoken goal is escape.
Oh, escape.
Escape pod.
But there's no better place to live than here.
For now.
What if
I'm Jeff Bezos and I can make Taos on Mars for me and all my friends, and then it doesn't matter if the glaciers melt or the bomb goes off, which I mean, they've done the math and they're like, well, this is inevitable at this point. There's going to be a plague or nanotech or something, meteor strike. We need a backup plan. And who has the means to make sure they're part of the backup plan? Oh, me, Jeff Bezos.
Mars is no kind of place to raise your kids. I assumed that...
Yeah, and Elon's got like 8 kids. He's got a nanny.
I thought that...
Mars is a great place for your nanny to raise your kids.
Billionaires were all going to protect themselves by moving to bunkers in New Zealand, I thought. New Zealand is the Mars of the world.
It's the Mars of the 50s. Oh. That's like on the beach, everyone's like, hey, the fallout's coming to Australia last. Pretty sweet. But now we're like, no, whatever happens will be global. Eventually, it'll get to my polar bunker. I need to be thinking bigger.
I saw that Matt Damon movie. I have zero interest in going to Mars.
Yeah.
I would go to the moon for like a weekend.
I'd go to Mars for a weekend. The problem is it would take like 8 months to, for your getaway.
I see. Right.
Yeah. So this is the future now. Private space enterprises. And it kind of matches with our new idea that our new post-Reagan idea that government's crap, basically. Yeah. The government just messes stuff up. It doesn't matter whether it's you hate the IRS or you hate the Bureau of Land Management.
Darn old government.
Or you hate the Clintons killing Vince Foster. Yeah. Whatever you hate about government.
Welfare moms.
Oh, man. I hate them.
Ugh.
We don't.
When is really Elon Musk going to do something about all the welfare moms?
It's kind of the same impulse, I think.
We are being sardonic, by the way, to those of you with no calibration, with no ability to calibrate vocal inflection.
For those of you who just read me saying I hate welfare moms on Omnibus out of context, let me just say no. Those are brave people facing challenges I've never even had to think about.
Right. It's a straw man. It's a boogeyman.
It's a Reagan era, Lee Atwater era boogeyman. But. You know, we don't trust government to do this stuff anymore.
Frankly, I do. But yes, you're right. I don't.
Sorry. A big swath of people, especially these people with the illusion that they're self-made men who can do anything, are like, well, you know, I don't trust NASA anymore. You know, the future is going to be, you know, as we've always said, NASA's not always been the best at branding.
No, NASA's kind of, I know we have a lot of listeners, a lot of futurelings do work for NASA. We hear from them all the time.
Love NASA.
So in that sense, you know, big high five, attaboys.
Not just nostalgia for me either. Although that's a huge part of NASA's appeal is tall white men in Corvettes.
Yeah.
But I love it all. I love the multicultural people landing us on Mars too.
They weren't tall astronauts. They had to fit in those little tanks.
In those little Corvettes.
Yeah, in the little Corvettes.
What's the height requirement for a Mercury or Apollo?
They were they were Navy pilots, and those people aren't very tall either.
Are you saying if I meet an astronaut, he's going to be like my height, 5'10" and a half or shorter?
Average height of Mercury astronaut.
I mean, Buzz Aldrin is 108, and so he's probably lost an inch.
Because of the small space inside the Mercury spacecraft, candidates could be no taller than 5'11 and weigh no more than 180 pounds.
Buzz Aldrin is my height.
Look at that.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
But so, I might be able to beat up an astronaut.
So it says,
living the dream.
The average height of an astronaut is between 62 and 75 inches.
So I looked at Buzz Aldrin's height, and Google helpfully says, people also search for Neil Armstrong, 5'11", Michael Collins, 5'11", Hank Azaria, 6 foot.
Hank Azaria.
I'm trying to figure this out. Was he, Harry Shearer's in the right stuff, but Hank Azaria is not. What is the connection between Hank Azaria and astronauts? Is it because he's named Hank, the most astronaut name? The last Hank.
The shortest astronaut was Peggy Whitson, who was, I think, 5 feet tall. And she was on the, she was the first female commander of the space station.
Did you know there is one Vostok cosmonaut still alive?
What, really?
Yes.
Wow. Are they like 95? I bet their chest is adorned with so many flashy medals.
I was hoping I could get you on the pronoun, but you kept saying they. It is Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman in space.
Well done.
5'5".
Valentina.
And only 88, because she was like, you know, she was like 4 and a half when they put her in space. She was like Webster. why are we talking about that? Right. Because astronauts are in the
billionaires.
Oh, no. But I still like NASA's new albums are great.
Yeah. No. It's right. They just had a weird Christian period in the '70s.
Pathfinder and Perseverance. I mean, the names are too long. Sojourner. The names are all like 10 letters. But great little rovers.
Why did they stop naming them after Greek gods? We could have had the Daphne program. We could have had the Eos or the Isis program.
Well, Sojourner is explicitly multicultural, which is something that will come up in this episode.
Named after Sojourner Truth?
Kind of. They asked American school children to submit essays about, you know, which famous woman would you name the probe after? And so,
wait a minute.
the Mars mission. Sorry. After. And they got a lot of, you know, this would be the Sally Ride, or this would be the, And but sojourner is just sitting right there because it means
right. You know,
traveler, wanderer, and it's sojourner truth. So
even you know, better.
So that's kind of a big step away from kind of these classical masculine Greek, you know, Apollo.
Yeah, but Minerva,
they're all male.
Think about Minerva. What a great
I feel like in sci-fi it's often Artemis because it's like the know, Apollo. It shouldn't have been Apollo anyway. Apollo's a sun god. It always should have been Artemis. But I don't know if we ever actually used a goddess for any of these things, did
no,
we?
No, unlikely.
Gemini, two dudes. That's twice the toxic masculinity.
Gemini, as space fans would call it.
I have your word for that and nobody else's. But the history of private, so we trust private space because, you know, Google and Amazon, they're really good at branding, you know, and NASA has had periods of not being great at persuading America of their importance or their mission. And the space shuttle looks like a bus and they kept blowing up.
How do you feel about the like sub or, the, you know, the high atmosphere balloons that are bringing Wi-Fi to Africa? The big balloons.
What's the right take to have on them? I'm for them if they're good.
Well, I mean, do you believe that the world needs more internet?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a thing that I think we're just beginning to question now, whether, I mean, I'm personally in favor of less internet, but...
I don't like it when Coke bottles fall off of them because it leads to hijinks.
Right, right. Lots of hijinks.
Yeah. They really shouldn't even put Coke bottles on those balloons. when they launch them.
What are they doing?
Why are they even there?
Oh, don't let people drink Coke in space balloons.
We keep dancing around the idea of space in Africa. Let's get to it.
Okay.
Because
let's stop dancing.
The Bezos Allen Musk era of
that's what I called the Bezos Allen Musk. Yeah, that's good.
The BAM era.
You know, they do my taxes.
BAM. It doesn't sound like a law firm because it has Musk in it.
Yeah.
Bezos Allen Musk sounds like something that your internet startup smells like. There's a very powerful Bezos Allen Musk in here. We need to go need to fumigate the foosball table.
You've been to Blue Origins, haven't you?
No, you're thinking of you.
Oh, that's right. I've been to Blue Origins.
Classic John way to tell a story.
Wait a minute.
You played Sasquatch, didn't you? No, but why don't you tell us about when you did?
Well, let's go on. We'll get back to Blue Origins.
No, you can talk about Blue Origins.
No. I have zero interest in talking about Blue Origins. No, that's not true.
You've seen the future of privatized space up close. Do you believe in it?
I have. I've been inside the capsule. Although it didn't have seats in it.
Was it like Space Camp? Did it take off while you were like, accidentally take off while you were in there?
No, but you know, they have a giant factory and it's a true factory. They're building rocket engines. They're making rockets. And they're doing the whole nine. Like they've got USB, they've got cup holders.
It seems weird to have a non-governmental entity. But is that just because I'm a Gen Xer, or is there something weird about private enterprise in space?
Well, you know, what about that guy that built a rocket so he could fly up and make and prove that the world was flat? A rocket with a lawn chair. I mean, people have been building rockets in their backyards ever since Goddard.
You're saying the Montgolfier brothers build, you know, sending up a sheep in a hot air balloon over Paris. This is just the spiritual descendant of that. You can't keep mankind on the earth.
Well, no, I wonder is the fact that we think of the space program as a statist enterprise.
It's just a Cold War side effect that's an accident.
Or a mid-century, yeah, right, or like a World War II fallout situation, you know, fallout maybe being the wrong choice of words, but if...
Consequence.
If it hadn't been for World War II and if it hadn't been for the kind of Rooseveltian... mega government idea of how we or Eisenhowerian sort of, you know, build the highways sense of what government does, maybe it would have been a private enterprise all along.
It would have been NASA would be in White Plains, New York.
I know our libertarian listeners are jumping for joy that I'm making this argument. I'm not sure I believe it, but it's interesting.
All we needed was some Ayn Randian hero in the 50s, like standing astride a big Saturn rocket like Howard Rourke.
Yeah, that's right.
Getting ready to boink Patricia Neal's brains out.
It does feel like you could not have had the... the Apollo program, that accomplishment was so great. No industrialist you know, the Ford Motor Company couldn't have accomplished it.
So the line here is that the U.S. had to do it because the Soviets were doing a governmental entity, which means it's communist, the idea that the private billionaire should not be in space.
I want, but
it's Marxist-Leninist.
They're never, well, wait a minute. I mean, the Mercury program, those rockets were, you could have built a Mercury rocket if you were General Motors.
If you were Tom Swift.
Don't you think? Couldn't General Motors, if there had been a mining concession, they could have built a Mercury rocket, but they couldn't have gotten to the moon. So mining is straight out. They could have mined
I like how everything's mining asteroids. To you. Like,
well, yeah.
Your flowchart of the future is, and what are they mining? And if the answer is nothing, you're like, well, what's the point? But,
you know,
but they met the Vulcans. You're like, yeah, but what were they mining? But was there bauxite?
What were the Vulcans mining?
Was there bauxite?
We need rare earths.
You go to Star Trek movies and you're like, there's no vanadium here. Who the hell cares? But there is a parallel universe where.
Oh boy, are we getting into parallel universes?
There's a possible way the 20th century could have gone where private space exploration started much earlier, and in fact, in sub-Saharan Africa. So let's introduce the protagonist. I don't want to say hero of this entry. Lutz Thilo Kaiser. He's German, and his name is Kaiser.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit on the nose. Well,
as soon as you said Lutz, I was like, the Zaire space program.
The Zaire space program is run by Bavarians, as you would expect of any kind of weird mad science endeavor.
Right. Although the Germans that ran the mad science stuff were all, they were all from Hamburg, I thought.
Oh, yeah, you're right. So we got the hamburgers.
Right, and they got the Bavarians.
Hamburger, hamburger, bang, bang, which was the motto of Operation Paperclip. And the Bavarians were left for the developing world. That's exactly what happened. You know, a lot of those Nazi rocket scientists came over to America after the war. Kaiser was a little younger. He grew up in the debris of World War II, actually literally playing with rocket debris.
Parts.
Rocket parts, yeah.
Wow.
That had fallen on Berlin or whatever. And he was, so it was in his blood. And as a result, he apparently became a fan. He wrote fan letters to Wernher von Braun as a young man. I guess, you know, those weren't von Braun's rockets that took out Germany.
No.
So he's not admiring von Braun's work. He would have had to go to London for that.
It might have been finding like bomb fins and stuff. I'm not sure how many rockets were launched against Bavaria.
Right.
When I was a kid up in Alaska.
Explosive debris.
Explosive debris. When I was a kid in Alaska, there was one of our neighbors had a bomb, a full bomb. It was a dud in their living room, and they claimed to have dug it out of the creek that ran behind our neighborhood housing complex, because in World War II.
It was World War II era?
Armament? They were using the creek as a training, you know, a bomb run training site.
Was it unexploded? Like, did somebody have to get called in to?
No, it was like a practice bomb, but it looked like a bomb.
Kaiser loved the idea of explosives from a very young age. And he asked von Braun, like, how do I become an astronaut? And von Braun actually wrote back to this young German kid. Maybe he saw a little bit of him in that kid and said, look, you want to be an engineer, rockets. That's the future. You know, you know, you're not going to be in the capsule, but you could be a scientist. And Kaiser took that to heart. And by 1975, he and some fellow scientists and investors and engineers, including von Braun on board as a, you know, probably in name only consultant, have founded in Stuttgart an outfit called OTRAG, O-T-R-A-G, the world's first private space enterprise, 40 years before Blue Origin or SpaceX or I forgot one. What's the third one?
Experience Rocket Project.
Moonrisoft. Yeah, whatever the third one is. But this one had the not catchy name. They hadn't discovered that branding was going to be a big part of privatization of space. OTRAG is just Orbital Transport und Raketen AG, which is, you know, incorporated.
Right.
Aktiengesellschaft. And their operating principle was... you know, Germany had kind of gotten out of the space program.
The rocket business.
Well, Germany, that'll come into the story. Germany had joined the European Space Agency And so there wasn't any government money for space research now, because there was this kind of pan-European thing that was coming together to challenge. Because right now, at the moment, in the 70s, all space exploration was either running out of NASA or Moscow. And the European Space Agency had cut, you know, Europe had decided we need to come together if we're going to play in this field at this level. There wasn't any, you know, now there wasn't any cash for private endeavors. So OTRAG had to be like the bargain option, like the space IKEA or the space Marshalls or something. You know, they were like not high tech, but low cost.
When you say Marshalls, you mean the discount department store and not the sheriffs.
Yes. Or the plan.
I don't want them to be the space sheriffs.
No, they would never have been the Marshalls. So they did everything on the tightest possible shoestring budget. You know, instead of the aluminum alloys that the big boys were using, they said all our rockets are going to be just stainless steel.
Mm.
You know, and today it would be something even lighter, it'd be some carbon allotrope or something. You know, they would, if they needed a fuel injection system, you know, their first thought was
carburetors.
Even worse, windshield wiper motor from a Volkswagen.
Wow, like they're really doing it.
Yeah, this is going to be backyard. Let's put on a show, space stuff, and they were proud of this. They were like, "This is going to be the future. If we do this in an efficient assembly line way, like space will be cheap, and therefore, you know, that'll advance the science.
You can use pump gas,
right? Well, they actually used kerosene.
Oh, sure.
Their rocket fuel was literal lamp kerosene, and their whole idea was that it would be kind of a component system, like Lego, you know, that they'd build a bunch of small little fuel tanks and boosters and all the other components you need. And then for whatever the launch or the mission was, they would combine a bunch of their assembly line interchangeable components and produce the system you needed. This has not been tried before since, possibly because it's a terrible idea.
You know, jet fuel is kerosene. I mean, we use kerosene now as jet fuel.
Not like, this is not any kind of fancy refined kerosene. This was like hardware store stuff you put in your camping lamp in 1975.
Waxy kerosene.
Yeah. So it was like, I mean, it's going to burn.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
But they're not spending a lot of money on what's the, you know, what has the best propulsion like NASA is. You know, there's no super cooled gases or anything like that.
I almost feel like I would rather ride a rocket like this.
Because you understand the parts?
Yeah, just because, you know, you're strapping yourself onto a thing that might explode, which feels like more adventure.
I do think that when I drive and I realize I can no longer fix even the simplest thing in this car because it's all electronic now.
Yeah.
You know, there's a microprocessor involved in almost anything I would want to do here, except maybe change the oil. Even the interface of my wife's Volvo, I realize... Like yesterday, I wanted to make it so the radio station would tell you, it would show the subcarrier so you know what song is playing. You know how the stations have the little thing now?
Yeah.
And it was like a Android phone. It was like 8 screens deep. And I was like, you know what? Like, I never had this problem with a car radio on my Dodge, you know?
I'm driving a Ford now. And
congratulations. This is our first show where you're a...
proud Ford owner.
An owner of a car that was from this century.
But the emergency brake, when I put on the emergency brake, it's no longer mechanical. I push a button and I hear the emergency brake go zzzt. And it's like, I don't think that was a thing that needed to be electrified.
I was renting a Nissan last week in LA, which still had one of the push brakes where you go click, 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 because Nissan still have those.
Yeah.
And all week, whether I've been driving my car or my wife's car, I am still have phantom limb pain of trying to push the actual parking brake. And then there's nothing there. And I'm like, oh, right. I have to flip a little thing on the center console, which goes ping. And that means the parking brake is set.
It doesn't instill a ton of confidence in me.
Do you know how the Volvo starts now? It's got like a twist thing, like bop it.
Bop it.
Like
it
is literally an interface that exists nowhere on earth except for bop it. But it really is like, hey, you know what? Everybody's got push button now. What seems futuristic? What can we do? And so, yeah, once again, we've been, unlike OTRAG, where we keep getting abstracted away from what's actually happening under the hood. So you would like to ride one of these Lego rockets, Lego IKEA rockets?
No, but it does feel like something that I would have built or tried to build. It feels like something I would have absolutely ridden when I was 20.
That's 24. Not what I want in a rocket, is something that like a musician could build in their backyard.
That I might have built.
But yeah, it does remind me of a lot of those like sci-fi books I read as kids where little kids could just build backyard rockets.
And go to the moon. We didn't understand how gravity worked then. Not that we do now. But we hadn't made
it. When I read The Wonderful Flight to the Mushroom Planet when I was like 8, I was like, how come I don't have a sea captain grandpa who can give me like cool curved hull pieces? Because that, if I could just put it on a wooden scaffolding and I'd be on the mushroom planet right away.
Right.
Like David and Chuck. But this guy actually tried it. My man here, Lutz Tilo Kaiser, actually out here building IKEA rockets out of stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is they needed a test site. And mm-hmm. as you may
Pienemood.
The reason why we, what's that?
Pienemood, which was the German, and I'm not sure that I pronounced that correctly, but.
Where was?
Pienemood, that's the German, on the North Sea, the German rocket launching site.
Oh, for like, if you want to hit for London?
For the V2 rocket.
Well, there's a reason why you don't want to launch space rockets from there. Do you know why NASA launches from Florida and Russia launches from Kazakhstan?
Is it the warm weather makes the air thinner?
Yeah, you can take the roof off your Corvette.
it's just clear skies?
The closer to the equator you are, the faster the Earth is rotating.
Oh, sure.
And therefore, I mean, that's one thing you gotta give the equator.
Centrifugal force.
It's sure rotating faster than we are.
Or centripetal force. Which is it? Which force?
Centrifugal is illusory and feels like it's pushing you outward. Yeah, it would be centripetal. But yeah, easier to get to
slingshot
escape velocity because the Earth is pushing you at a faster speed there than it is at Stuttgartian latitudes.
But Cape Canaveral, I mean, they could have gone down, the United States at that point in time could have gone down and colonized Ecuador, right? It wouldn't have been that much harder.
Kind of surprised they didn't. Yeah, I wonder. I haven't done the math. I wonder how much better it is. Like, I wonder if you get most of the bump just from getting to Florida.
Or like build a space station in it or space rocket launch place in American Samoa or something. It just, I'm surprised that
Florida. The European Space Agency, I think, uses French Guiana for that reason.
Right.
Well, I mean, and also the fact that they haven't given it back. Hey, and they look at a map and they're like, what didn't we give back?
Yeah.
Bingo.
Curacao.
Right here. So they need someplace equatorial. And in 1974, Don King enters the story.
No, he does not.
Yes, he does.
Is this is right after the rumble in the jungle, right? In Zaire?
That's what happens. So, you know, Congo got its...
Wait, did I get that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
There's a rumble in the jungle connection.
There's a Muhammad Ali connection.
Here. Wow. Yeah.
So, you know, in the 1950s, when the Democratic Republic of the Congo received its independence from Belgium, you know, it was run by...
Thank God.
Democratically, yo.
I still celebrate that every day. Every year.
And which day of the year do you celebrate Congo's Independence Day on?
I picked August 4th.
Something about that day just conveys Patrice Lumumba to you.
Yeah.
So the democratically elected kind of nationalist, you know, the father of the Congo is Patrice Lumumba. But in 1961, he is overthrown by Joseph Désiré Mobutu.
Good old Mobutu, the name comes into play.
Yes. He will Africanize his name to Mobutu Sese Seko, getting rid of the French colonial part.
Right.
And he will rebrand the Congo as Zaire, an African place for Africans, which is funny because, you know, Congo was the original name of the tribe there. Zaire is a Portuguese word. But at least it does come from Nzera, the local word for river, which is what they call, you know, they called the Congo River the Nzera Congo, the river that flows by the Congo people. So, you know, it's kind of legit.
So it's Portuguese for river.
Well, it's Portuguese for that particular
river. The name
of
that river.
Yeah, it's Portuguese for the Congo River, which comes from Nzera, which just means, you know, all rivers just are the local name for river because, you know, if you're a tribe living next to the Missouri River, that's the river. It's pretty good.
Right. Columbia River is not named after the local word for river.
I'm sure the native word is.
Columbia?
You think whatever the coastal tribes called it, you think they called it the Columbia?
No, they absolutely didn't call it the
Columbia.
That's
what I'm saying. I see. Their name would have been the equivalent of Nzera.
Something else, right?
They just would have called it
the Big River.
Or Big River, yeah. Because they, They didn't know there were bigger rivers.
That was the biggest river.
It's a pretty good one.
I'm not even sure there are bigger rivers.
you're a flat.
You prove should it.
Build a lawn chair to go into space so that you can see if there's a bigger river than the Columbia. Mobutu, it runs a terrible, corrupt kleptocracy for decades.
Mobutu installed himself in 1961?
I believe so,
yeah. Wow.
Now I'm going to check the date. And I'm going to do it without stopping tape, just so that people know that I'm not like... Yeah, no, he overthrew the government in 1960. In 61, he executes Lumumba. He kind of runs a weird kind of, you know, kind of maybe the North Korean game of, you know, I'm the little fish. I got to play everybody off against each other. So, you know, this guy's Pan-African, but, you know, the communists, the Russians are next door in Angola.
Right.
And he wants, you know, he doesn't want to cut off ties with the West. So he's anti-Soviet, you know, he's getting strong support from the US and NATO because he's on the record as being anti-communist. But then he allies with Mao, who is also anti-Soviet, but, you know, holding to the same kind of agrarian principles that'll play well at home with his increasingly impoverished people because he's taken all the money and, you know, flying Concords to Paris to just buy a new leopard skin pillbox hat.
But the U.S. government was also pouring money into Zaire, weren't they, in order to fight the Soviets?
That's right.
Yeah.
So he's like Mr. Pan-African, but he's got the support of the Johnson and then Nixon administrations.
He's like Ceausescu or Tito, kind of situating himself.
Playing both sides, yeah. Right. And it's weird because he's doing it from sub-Saharan Africa, very far from his allies in America or in Maoist China, or oddly for a pro-African, he's an authoritarian at heart. So you shouldn't be surprised that he's close economic allies with apartheid South Africa, although it sure doesn't look good on paper, with Israel, for example, which would, raise the eyebrows of some of his Northern African neighbors.
You know what? It was Haile Selassie, I think, that was influencing everybody in this the most. You know, he was sort of behind that Pan-African, same exact period of time.
That's right. And, Selassie's a little earlier, but, you know, that's a vision of Africa that was never colonized except for a brief Italian adventure.
Right.
You know, so it's a thing. So there's some symbolic pride to it. And we should get to that because that's the whole reason why he wants a space program, is because that's prestige and the future. And that's the same reason why he meets with Don King about finding a place to put an Muhammad Ali, George Foreman match. This would obviously be the biggest heavyweight boxing match of the early 70s.
Which was a time when the heavyweight championship of the world was still a major social sporting event.
No bigger sports event, really. And like two larger than life, Muhammad Ali, the great mouth of the 20th century.
Right.
And then, you know, his perfect counterpart, George Foreman, who is not the cuddly man of our era, the cuddly family man of our era, but just a menacing, a tight-lipped bruiser with little to say, the perfect counterpoint to Ali's agility and braggadocio.
But there was no bigger sports figure than Muhammad Ali at this point.
Hard to say there's a bigger cultural figure, white or black. I mean, he's a colossus, and he's missed the best years of his career due to his ban for his opposition to the Vietnam War. But he's back. He's still apparently in belt-worthy form. And everybody wants an Ali Foreman match, but nobody can figure out how to make the money work. Don King says, I can get you $5 million if you go with me, Ali. Because King's still a young hotshot promoter, not part of anybody's usual team. But he says he can get Ali $5 million. And Ali says, for $5 million, set it up. But he can't find any place in like America or the developed world that will do it for that. He needs some place that will help subsidize it and do it on the cheap. And he turns to the kleptocrats of Central Africa.
And you've seen the movie, right? You saw the documentary. The
When We Were Kings?
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
It is great.
It's like footage that was taken at the time, you know, contemporary interviews with all the, you know, who's there? George Plimpton or Norman Mailer or Gore Vidal or somebody. Like all these, you know, all these people at the time just loved heavyweight boxing and all these period interviews that were never seen until the mid-90s when this documentary came out and won the Oscar. And of course, everyone in Africa loves Ali. You know, he's a symbol of the pride and the dignity of the African diaspora. You know, children trail after him wherever he goes. Everybody hates Foreman, who's playing up to his reputation.
You know, I'm only one degree of separation away from the rumble in the jungle.
How does that work?
I'm not,
because you saw the documentary. Yeah, me too.
No. I'm never sure about how that degree of separation thing works. I might have to do an episode on that. But my dad's best friend, Jack Tanner.
That's already 2 degrees.
Oh, is that 2 degrees? my dad's best friend, Jack Tanner, was representing the Puyallup tribal leader, Robert Satyakam. Tanner's involved. Tanner goes. And Satyakam, who later on became a very, very problematic figure, at the time was already a problematic figure, although he didn't. Satyakam, I think, later on had some other crimes that were less palatable. But at the time he was like involved in creating, he had a bunch of graft, and but he was part of the Indian rights movement.
Yeah.
But he was, and so he was wanted by the FBI, but also, you know, I don't know. There was a lot of shady dealings, and Tanner was his lawyer. And at a certain point they had to get out of the country. And so, because they were being chased by the FBI. And so Satyakam and Tanner put a bunch of cash in a paper bag, and they got on an airplane and they flew to Thailand, I think, and they traded the cash for a bunch of rubies. And then they ended up at the rumble in the jungle trying to escape the FBI.
It's like a heist movie that ends in a prize fight.
It was incredible. And they were both there. And they, you know, Tanner used to tell me the story of the rumble in the jungle, you know, firsthand.
He saw the fight. He was in the stands.
He was there. Yeah. So I don't know how many degrees of separation that puts me from the rumble in the jungle, but
if Tanner goes, it's just two.
The thing is, I don't know. I don't think that story has ever been told. It will never be told because all these guys are dead now. Although no, Satyakam is still alive.
Once you write a book.
You know what? I'm going to go interview him. Is he in prison? No. I'm going to interview Satyakam, and we're going to put this story into film.
This is going to be a 10-part true crime podcast. This is going to be your first true crime podcast, and you're going to make your millions.
Yeah. Here.
Oh,
wait a minute.
And the fight lives up to its...
No, this... Robert Satyakam is... Yeah, okay, never mind.
Long dead?
Yeah, he died in 1991. But his son is still alive.
But what a get it would be if you could interview him after his 1991 death. The fight lives up to its reputation. You know, it's the famous one where Ali does his rope-a-dope, where he, like, lets Foreman tire... You know, Foreman's got, like... 3 inches of reach on him or something.
Right. Massive fist.
So Ali just kind of he's not dancing. He's kind of tiring him out. You know, I mean, he's using the ropes. He's ducking everything. And, you know, in the late rounds, Foreman's all tuckered out. And even though he's a huge favorite, like Ali wins by knockout, I think. Anyway, Kaiser runs into a German businessman who was kind of instrumental in helping, you know, bring the fight there and all the infrastructure. And the fight was, you know, Mobutu poured in his people's money, and it was a big thing on the world stage that made him look fancy, which is all he ever wanted.
Right.
So it's a big hit for him. And this German businessman meets Kaiser and says, look, you should talk to Mobutu. Like, Zaire's perfect for this. And in December of 1975, Mobutu agrees to give Otrag 100,000 square kilometers of... Uh-huh. Southern Zairean wilderness, like four times the size of Belgium, which used to be the landlord. And now this is all just Otrags to do with as they will. And
presumably not a single living soul lived there already.
I'm sure the local residents were mostly what they need is this single plateau rising out of the jungle, which looks to them, they've surveyed it and it seems perfect for rocket launches. And they open what they call the Bavarian Embassy there, which is a full little mini town of German engineers with slide rules in their pockets and their little beer canteen.
Right.
You know, they got a little beer garden there in the jungle.
Pretzel bakery.
And they've got a pretzel bakery and a tuba band and Lederhosen outside the post office. They even buy a bunch of old, like, BOAC commercial aircraft, and they start up what they call... you know, Otrag Airlines or something. You know, they set up their own little mini airline to shuttle them back and forth. You know, they clear jungle and clear an airstrip, and a lot of a lot of infrastructure goes into launching a rocket program from just the wilds of southern Zaire.
You got to figure out how to make concrete.
There's stuff like that. So when they do their first launch, the scaffolding of the rocket is just like wooden trunks and branches from local trees.
Right.
You know, like you might see on the outside of a building project in Manila.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they're launching rockets from it. In May 1977, they have their first test. The rocket just looks like a big stainless steel pencil, 6 meters tall.
That's not very tall.
No. It's a small, why does it have to be 6 meters? What is that? It's 15 or 20 feet.
18 feet.
I mean, it's not, you're not getting to Mars, but this is a proof of concept.
Oh, I see. Yeah. It's it feels like a big model rocket though.
It is a big model rocket. Yeah, okay. That's exactly what it is. They're testing out this component system for the first time.
I see.
And it's a big success.
Oh, it does. I thought you were going to say it starts an enormous fire.
And it kills millions of people and leads to a massive civil war in Central Africa. No, that could all easily have happened, but the test is a big success. Mobutu takes note. Everybody takes note. Because, you know, Mobutu wasn't just interested in the prestige. Like, if this actually becomes a space program, think about what it would mean for a developing African, I mean, not democracy, but nation state to have its
own... Post-colonial nation
to have its own space program.
Yeah.
You could launch spy satellites.
Oh, yeah.
You could keep an eye on whatever the Russian, what's the name of the Russian thing? The communists in Angola to right to his south. You know, he's got a burgeoning communist movement to right to his south. And so, hey, with spy satellites, I can keep an eye on, not UINTA, UNESCO.
UNESCO. No, it wasn't UNESCO. UNESCO was a, it was SWAPO.
SWAPO, is that right? Yes. Is that what I'm thinking of?
SWAPO. Yeah.
I'm going to Google.
Well, no, that was the Namibian.
That's what, I'm going to Google Angola.
No, it was the MPLA.
Communist.
No, UNITA. Acronym. UNITA.
There we go. The UNITA biscuit. That's right. UNITA, right?
Right.
Yeah, because Johnny Unitas was a.
A big supporter.
Marxist freedom fighter in Southern Africa. So Mobutu thinks like this is huge for his regional power. Unfortunately, everybody else is keeping an eye on it too. The Soviets, the U.S. does not want this tin pot guy to have rockets, obviously.
Right.
Because you're just one step away from ballistic missiles.
Yeah, right? From menacing South Africa or...
And even Mobutu never says that. You know, he never says, I want a weapons program. But he does say, I want a surveillance program. The Soviets hate it because, you know, he's a pro-Western influence, threatening, the possibility of global revolution in Southern Africa.
Right. We should say that this was that post-colonial Africa was a real chessboard of the superpowers during the Cold War.
Which government is our puppet and which government's their puppet?
Yeah. And they almost certainly did not want any one of those governments to actually attain
orbit.
Right.
Worst case scenario.
So are you saying that that spies were throwing spanners into the works?
Yeah. And literally, I mean, I don't know about actual sabotage, but a lot of, disinformation. What's the word for like Cold War era? Counterintelligence kind of, like the Soviet propaganda machine started announcing that Germany in effect now had a space program because all these guys were Bavarian. And, you know, if Germany is now launching spy satellites, this actually goes against the demilitarization of post-Nazi Germany, the Brussels Agreement of 1954.
They're appealing to the UN to shut it down.
They're saying, hey, NATO, what's this deal? Like Germany can't be launching rockets. You remember last time Germans had a rocket button, right? And this is actually quite successful because nobody on the planet Earth wants Mobutu Sese Seko to have, you know, it's analogous to Kim Il-sung's missile tests and nuclear tests. Like nobody on either side wants that guy to have a button.
Well, and also, Pinamund, God, why can I not pronounce that word?
It's my favorite kind of small batch ice cream.
It's actually in East Germany, so we couldn't have the Bavarians couldn't have been launching rockets from there. They were already there were East Germans over there.
And Germany didn't have any other warm weather colonies because, well, they were all, World War II.
Right.
But luckily Mobutu was there. And the Soviets start spreading rumors that this is going to be a weapons program, which makes everybody more nervous.
Gaddafi's now not into it.
Gaddafi's going to come into the story in a second.
Of course.
So there's a second test, which is successful. And Mobutu is now happy enough that he actually travels to the Katanga province for the third test. And is proudly there as the rocket launches and immediately nosedives back to Earth. A huge, embarrassing disaster. And Mobutu is humiliated. He's been made a fool of. He cancels funding for the project. He tells them they can't have their, you know, access anymore.
Oh, I wish he'd gone to the first launch.
he'd still be the president of Zaire today. There wouldn't be two Congos, which is confusing.
Zaire would have a moon colony.
I still feel one of the Congos should have to rename themselves, not for any kind of ideological reasons, but just because we now have the Democratic Republic of the Congo and the Republic of the Congo.
Right. Well, this is the Macedonian problem, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Everybody's fighting over the historical name. But in this case, I mean, the Republic of Congo, it implies they're not democratic. They've got a neighbor that's... It would be like if Canada was called the Democratic United States of America.
Yeah.
Would we put up with that?
Diss.
I mean, it would be true, but we wouldn't love it.
It could have been the former Congolese Republic of the Congo.
Yeah, I love the FCRC. And unfortunately, I mean, now that you mention, like, was there Soviet... was there sabotage going on? Shortly after this rocket exploded for the first time, a boat accident killed a lot of the leading scientists on a local river.
Uh-huh. Boat accident.
So I'm not going to say that this was an operation.
A boat. This is no boating accident.
The whole thing falls apart just within a matter of a couple of years. And Zaire's space program is no more. What happens to Lutz and his new wife? He's got a new young wife. I think he's been married twice, but he's got a new young wife named Susie.
Is she Congolese?
No. Oh. She's extremely German. Every dictator in the world now wants to hang out with these guys.
Oh, wow. Of course.
Because this is the guy that gave Mobutu a rocket program.
Yeah, start a rocket program for me.
So, you know, he's staying at Saddam Hussein's guest palace. And he's, you know, Imelda Marcos throws a parade for him. And most prominently, Gaddafi just wants to have this guy in house.
This is before all these dictators precipitated like famines all around the world, and it was still pretty fashionable to hang out with them.
Yeah, all these dictators. The main thing you knew about them was how eccentrically and lavishly they dressed.
Yeah, they all drove Mercedes 600s.
They, you know, Imelda Marcos had 8,000 pairs of shoes,
fun times.
Mobutu had all the leopard print. I mean, it really probably honestly helped minimize their atrocities. Which is a very smart move, then.
Sure.
If you're going to kill an ethnic minority, like, have a big, fun shoe closet. That's what Ellen DeGeneres did.
Ooh.
No.
Too soon.
She probably just has, like, two pairs of Adidas.
Tell me who got the closest to having a space program.
He spent the most time in Libya. For the next 28 years, Lutz and Susie are guests of Muammar Gaddafi. And, in fact, they are his only white friends. Like, they're his only Western friends, but he like hangs out with them because they tell him, yes, we're going to build you your Volks rocket. You know, you're this is going to be a big symbol for Libya.
Is this kind of like how Sony like signed a contract with you not to do another game show? rather than like sign a contract with you to do a game show, they just made sure that you weren't doing another game show?
I wonder if that's the thing. You put Kaiser in a nice guest house and you don't care if the rocket works.
Sure. There's no Sudanese rocket program in that case.
I guess. but yeah, Gaddafi openly wants, unlike Mobutu, he openly wants ballistic missiles that can hit Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
Sure.
That's all he wants.
And this was his big time, right? This was his big PLO hosting
time. This is early 80s. So the U.S. hasn't really, you know, Reagan hasn't bombed him yet. And so, you know, he's some Mobutu-like funny developing world character to the Kaisers. It's not like they're hanging out with Hitler, which, you know, honestly would not be a deal killer for them. But, you know, they love him. They're always talking about, oh yeah, he was so nice in the early days. You never seen somebody with looked so good in his Starks uniform. It was like a Greek god. Like Susie's always to this day mooning about what a handsome specimen young Momar was.
Greek god.
The young, is that not what you think when you see Colonel Gaddafi?
Well, I mean, maybe young Gaddafi was hotter.
Isn't he a Greek god with acne scars? Or am I just picturing all these developing world dictators as having bad skin?
I mean, young Gaddafi, sure, he's got a lot of charisma, sideburns, and he's got a penetrating glare.
Yeah, I'm looking at pictures, and he really does. I mean, he really is kind of aging rock star in his later days, with kind of the unwise facial hair and the obviously dyed kind of mop and the.
He looks like an angry Elliot Gould.
But when he's young, he's, you know, leading with his chin. I mean,
mm-hmm. His chin is always way out front. Look at that.
It really is.
You're right. He's got his, you know, he figured out how to take a good photograph.
And I guess maybe Susie just likes a man in uniform, you know, because he's always got all the medals that he gave himself.
You know, Mussolini was good at that too. You put your chin out.
But Mussolini just kind of looks like an angry shopkeeper telling you he's going to, you know, in Naples, telling you he's going to cut off your credit. I don't know.
Gaddafi doesn't look so good at the end.
That's what I'm saying. This is like his dissolute, you know, reunion tour photos.
Was this before he had an all-female bodyguard retinue?
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he had it all figured out.
So, you know, we actually had dictators as Bond villains before we had billionaires as Bond villains. And so 28 years, they're unsuccessful in building a Volks rocket. And
do they try?
Yeah, I mean, they resist Gaddafi's overt, could this be a ballistic missile kind of stuff.
Sure.
But they spend 20, you know, this is money for what he believes in, which is his component Lego system of rocket design, which he thinks is the future of space. Of course, then in 86, the U.S. bombs Libya. Apparently, it's, you know, we don't talk about this a lot, but apparently really hard on Gaddafi's psyche. Really a rough time for him.
Well, killed his niece or daughter or something.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
I guess Susie says it really changes him. And at some point she remembers, I had to tell him, Momar, I might love you, but I don't like you anymore.
Oh, Susie.
That's always a hard moment in your,
ouch,
in your friendship with an African dictator.
I didn't realize that this was also a YA novel.
Yeah. The interview with Susie I read really leaves it unclear as to whether or not
they were boinking.
Yeah. She's shacking up with Gaddafi while,
sounds like they were,
while Lutz is in the rocket shed.
So Lutz never made a rocket that went even into the lower atmosphere.
He never did. And in the year 2000, having lost his, you know, and, you know, Israel, much less the, you know, the Arab powers, much less Israel, are not crazy about Gaddafi having this program anyway. So there's tons of global opposition, as you can imagine, to him trying to build rockets for the new NATO boogeyman.
Right. Mossad was probably Stuxnetting the heck out of all of their, every time they hooked up a PC, it was like, bzzzt.
In the year 2000, with Gaddafi's days kind of numbered, he and Susie decide to leave. They retire to their own island in the Marshalls, in Micronesia.
Who's paying for their island?
Yeah, maybe they got a nice stipend to get the heck out of Tripoli, I guess.
Okay.
Where they open a guest house, you know, you for $700 a guest house for $700 a night, you can stay in there. They're, you know, kind of luxurious cabanas, and Susie will make you lemon cake. They, by all accounts, spend most of their days naked, kind of mystifying the locals.
But now in their 70s.
Yep. Exactly who you think would be naked in Micronesia, 70-year-old Germans. Saggy, leathery 70-year-old Germans.
I mean, in Micronesia, they are causing a lot less, they're a lot less dangerous than they would be anywhere else.
The president of the Marshall Islands does not want them to build Lego rockets, luckily,
right,
so they can live in happy retirement, where their hobbies apparently include, troublingly, in the Guardian profile I read, just an amazing collection of Third Reich memorabilia. Another huge shock. Like, they literally have what they claim to be a framed original Hitler up in the living room next to a Matisse and a Chagall or a Renoir or something. Chagall's probably a bad call. It wouldn't be a Jewish artist. Probably a Renoir.
But they had an original Hitler.
They have an original Hitler.
But and they also have an impressionist art collection.
Apparently, yeah, very depraved art.
Wait a minute, where did they get those paintings?
Yeah, whose paintings were those really? Mm. No, I don't think the art was Nazi, except for the Hitler, which was as Nazi as art can get.
Sure.
In the Guardian piece, they complained that their signed Mein Kampf has recently gone missing. Someone stole their signed copy.
Someone in Micronesia was like, I'm going to use this as firewood.
I bet it got out of the country. And Kaiser eventually died in 2017, having never brought, Mobutu's vision of an African space program to pass.
Is Susie still alive?
I believe so.
And more to the point, is she single?
You know, this, it's tempting to end there on such a delightful bon mot.
Yeah.
But I do want to mention kind of the modern reflection of this, which is, the late 70s when he's trying to build space rockets for Africa, it predates what we now call Afrofuturism.
Right, which is a whole movement, but it's more of a cultural movement rather than
philosophy. It's not actually pouring tech money into
space programs.
Yeah, black-owned IPOs or which maybe it should be, but it's more of a But it's more of a philosophy and a sensibility that what if science fiction were black? And I think maybe to a white audience it's tricky to understand why that's a thing. But imagine if you've been othered by hundreds of years of science fiction. If the message of all the sci-fi you saw is the face of the future is this white macho colonizer, He-Man, Flash Gordon type, dealing with the loincloth whoever's on Mongo or Mars. Or, maybe even worse, you're kind of your Heinlein crew-cutted technocrat with a slide rule. The future has always belonged to white people.
The white imagination.
In all these visions. Yeah, because we colonized the genre just like we colonized everything else.
Well, the wonderful thing about the early years of tech is it did offer the possibility of being completely colorblind, right? It's the ultimate meritocracy because it's all happening, but behind the terminal.
In a raceless space.
Raceless space.
Yeah, your avatar could be any color.
And there are so many black nerds that, that now that social media has become the future of tech, right? It became a different and much more complicated space. But I feel like the kind of inherent colorblindness of early tech really attracted a lot of people from from every walk of life to kind of say like, no, I belong here too.
And it took advantage of an existing kind of black nerd culture, which is, a story that's not often told, but goes back to, first of all, generations of people who liked the rule breaking and the kind of the open frontier nature of sci-fi, which is escape, it's escape from into superpowers or the solar system, but it's also an escape from a history of jails and auction blocks and overseers. And, it's a future where anything can happen. But more to the point, I was reading an interview with Samuel Delaney, like kind of the first African-American great science fiction author. And he pointed out that it was what was in front of him because it was cheap entertainment.
Right.
Like back when
Pulp magazine.
Yeah. Back when a young black audience was, maybe going to be guaranteed to be poorer than their white equivalent. Their entertainment was going to be cheaper. And as a result, it was pulp magazines and comic books.
Right.
And it created a generation of nerds just because all that stuff was a nickel,
I can't wait for a black space program. And I'm betting that their chief engineers are not Germans.
Wakanda forever.
And that concludes the Zaire space program. Entry 1455.PS11516. Certificate number 48059 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that space programs continue to be run by German engineers and that social media continues to document all of humanity's crimes, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are archived at Omnibus Project. You can find Ken Jennings tweeting away on Twitter at Ken Jennings. And I am, I think, primarily at my own Patreon at patreon.com/John Roderick. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. And more to the point, as Ken just said, you can support our show financially at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Thank you, by the way, to those of you who have done so.
And our patrons at patreon.com/omnibusproject have a whole panoply of extra benefits. Ken is ripping some paper on some physical mail we recently received at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. This is our mailing address, and you can send us postcards and packages. We get wonderful things. What did we get today, Ken?
Here's a postcard from Ari. It's addressed, I assumed it would be addressed to me because it's a picture of the Mormon temple in Nauvoo, Illinois.
I've been there. Have you been there? Been there too. Yeah,
I have. Yeah. But it's actually addressed to John and Ken.
I wonder how many podcast hosts have been to Nauvoo.
Probably all of them.
You think so?
It's required. Before you begin,
you think Joe Rogan has been to the Mormon temple in Nauvoo?
Yeah, they confiscated his vape, though.
It's beautiful there. Really, it's bucolic.
Yeah, it's nice. He was not there, however, to enjoy the Mormon pioneer history stuff, although there is plenty of that.
Wait a minute, I'm asking you if you've been there. Your grandfather was defenestrated for your great-great-great-grandfather.
In nearby Carthage, yeah. That's right. They came to hunt for geodes. Did you know Nauvoo is a good place to look for geodes?
No. Maybe, how would I have known?
Maybe that's why Joseph Smith chose it. Today they went to a place where everyone goes for geodes, says Ari, but he has a hot tip on a new site tomorrow, private property, where they might have bowling ball-sized geodes. I kind of want an update.
Did he tell us? Did he give us the address?
No, it's a secret. No. We can't announce it.
No. But we could know it. You and I can field trip. I hope we get it.
Yeah. So Ari, please send us an update and let us know if you found the mother load of geodes. We will not reveal the location. We also received the package I was opening here is from Monica. And there appears to be, is there no note? Oh, there is a note inside. It's a book of dirty cartoons.
I wonder which one of us is going to go home with this.
We mentioned Tijuana Bibles in which show?
Tijuana Bibles?
Oh, I can't remember. Chick Tracks, probably.
Chick Tracks, yeah, almost certainly.
They were there were these little mimeographed comic strips where your favorite cartoon and Sunday Funnies characters get up to,
right,
to like very explicit hijinks.
The internet version of it is all the Simpsons Rule 42 sites.
This is fantastic. Monica has noted in the past that she has seen every episode of Jeopardy. Is that even possible?
All the way back to pre-Alex days?
Fleming era. She used to watch it in the 60s. And then when it came back in the 80s, she was a new wife and mom always preparing dinner. So she always had it on. She even watched it if we were out of town, just like Rain Man.
Whoa.
But she says her streak has been broken.
Oh, no.
Because
because she couldn't stand LeVar Burton.
No, NBC fought with Comcast, so she lost her feed. And then the affiliate preempted, she must be from the Twin Cities because she said it got preempted for the Derek Chauvin trial.
Oh, sure.
Am I saying that right?
Yeah. Chauvin.
Who cares? That guy doesn't deserve to have his name spelled right. She listens to our podcast every day.
Every day.
Do you think she breaks each show up into three pieces, three and a half pieces?
Maybe she's listening to back catalog. You know, people like to listen to the episodes over and over because there's so much to glean.
And then she said, whoa, sent us this extremely explicit book about Betty Boop and Dagwood Bumstead getting it on.
Hello.
So this will be something for you. She also sent a cash donation. What if I get the cash and you get the dirty pictures of Blondie?
No, that looks like two crisp $20 bills.
You might want to see what Dagwood is packing before you turn down that offer.
Well, I mean, I'm going to get this anyway.
You know, I'm not taking that home.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, look, it's really happening in here.
Yeah,
Flash Gordon, yeah, Dick Tracy.
Putting the Flash back in Flash Gordon, putting the Dick back in Dick Tracy, putting the Wood back in Dagwood Bumstead.
What's wonderful,
it's got it all.
Is all of the heroines, all of the love interests here, they all have that great, like, super short flapper haircut,
yeah,
which I find very appealing.
Well, this is right up your alley, then. I hope you enjoy.
Oh, the Marx Brothers. Yikes.
Whoa, really?
That's not something I wanted to see.
Is Margaret Dumont the love interest?
Let's see here. Yeah, no.
That's delightful, Monica. That is not at all what we expected to receive from somebody who's seen every Jeopardy. But I don't think John's going to get to the rest of the intro.
The only thing I had left to say was seek out other futurelings wherever futurelings are sold.
Like on Facebook or
Reddit,
Discord. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. Hopefully the Wakandan space program got us all off the planet in time. Hopefully the catastrophe never comes at all. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.